If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss. Certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future.
Good morning and welcome to Money Matters here. Sunday morning, your host Wes Moss along with Connor Miller today. Back again. Connor does such a good job. I just keep asking if he would please come into the studio and join me to make things more interesting. And so far he said yes. I think there's only one time you were on a Disney cruise, weren't you?
Yeah, we did that earlier in the summer.
Yeah, so how was that?
It was enjoyable. We're a big Disney family, and honestly, cruises is probably one of the best things that they do.
So, but you don't love cruises though, do you? Is it more for the kids in Disney?
More for the kids, easy way to get the whole family together. So yeah, we all had a good time. But they do a really good job, good service, and
I hear people love those Disney cruises. I always hear if you're gonna go on a cruise, it was then going to Disney cruise with your kids. Obviously.
Yeah, it was probably the best cruise we've ever been on, just from a service standpoint, and the fact that it was only like 3 or 4 days helped too. So,
Well, better you on that cruise than for me. I don't think they let me and my 4 kids on one cruise. Nor could you pay me. Nor could you pay me to go.
After my kids
with my 4 kids
and the other cousins, I don't know if they're going to let us back on either.
You know, we had some big deals this week. We had the ARM IPO was one of the first big IPOs in a very, very long time. And then a public-private deal, J.M. Smucker purchased the Twinkie company, which is Hostess. That was a private company, but Twinkies have been around since the 1930s. J.M. Smucker's been around even longer, even further back than that. So we'll talk about that briefly as well. But then we had big news out of Apple released its new iPhones, and we had inflation numbers. And what we have talked about for the better part of a year and a half now, it's been topic really almost number one. So far in 2023, it was a big topic starting in 2022 and inflation started to spike. We've talked about how money matters. You could call it inflation matters because it's been the biggest driver of higher interest rates, and that really matters. So one is hit us in the wallet. Things got more expensive precipitously over the course of the last, call it 2 years. We've had massive inflation ever since the pandemic. And then the response to that with the Federal Reserve has been is really what the market has been watching every single day. Where is inflation going? And then what does that mean the Fed has to do to tame inflation? Markets got hit pretty badly in 2022 because of that. They've rallied and recovered in large part in 2023, but we're always on inflation watch. That inflation watch, and I think this is one of the most interesting stories of the week. I've asked this question throughout the year, and this is the first answer I've gotten. When it comes to higher interest rates, and if you're thinking about buying a house, we have been now served up a very different mortgage profile. We were at an event this week, and I talked to a longtime mortgage banker that I've worked with and known for 15 plus years. And she told me that her record locking in somebody, this is during when rates were at the very, very low. Her record for lowest rate ever lock-in, she said, was for a doctor client who she'd done several mortgages for him, had refinanced for him. They locked in a 1.5% 10-year mortgage.
Wow.
How do you like that? A 1.5% 10-year mortgage. And I think there was only a couple day window when that was available, but that was the low point, and that is her record.
Yeah, you've heard of some two handles from some friends, but I've never heard of one handle on a mortgage.
But this caught my attention too this week. This is in the cover of the Wall Street Journal, and The title of this, the headline here is a 3% mortgage in a grim 7% world? It's a question. Wait a minute. How can you do with it? A startup sees gold. So this is interesting. And this is, and I don't, this is a really brand new company. It is supposedly they're active now in a couple of states. Georgia happens to be one of those states. But evidently, assumable loans are something that are available. They're just not widely talked about. And they're not widely done. Supposedly, some, this is an estimate from Black Knight, which is a technology company that does mortgage data. Supposedly, 22% of active mortgages are part of some sort of government program, like the FHA, that allows for, these are mortgages that allow for assumptions. And last year, so call it 2022, a little over 2,500 mortgages were assumed. And this year so far, it looks like up to the end of September, this was the fiscal year ending at the end of this month, a little over 3,300 assumable mortgages or assumptive mortgages. And I guess the way this is supposed to work in real life, if somebody is selling their home and they've got a 3% interest rate and it happens to be an assumable mortgage, the buyer can, that can be their debt and they can keep that same low rate, which sounds amazing. I'm really surprised we haven't really heard about this. The example they give, a $500,000 house tied to an assumable mortgage that's $300,000, even after the buyer assumes the mortgage, they still have to come up with that $200,000. So I guess the challenge here would be you've got to pay for the rest of the balance of the house in order to assume this loan. Now, it looks like this company, Roam, which is, I'm not endorsing them at all because they're brand new. They only have it says 10 employees. They've got a little over $1 million in seed funding. One of the founders was at Open Door, supposedly. But I could see this concept. And again, I don't know if this company is the company that does it. But think about 22% of all mortgages have assumptive features. This could, the marketplace here could be really, really significant. So as a home seller, this could be an additional perk in buying the house. But what it could also do is drive up the price of the house. Oh, this comes with a really low interest rate mortgage. So then that home seller may be able to get more out of their home, even though they would be losing, probably, unless they found another assumable mortgage where they're buying, they'd be losing that. And I think that's the real problem in this market. It's one part high rates. It's another part people feeling like they have golden handcuffs in a low rate mortgage. So
yeah, I was going to say, I mean, yeah, think about what that would do to current home prices. That would be probably the first question that a buyer is going to ask a seller is, well, what first of all, is your loan assumable? And second, what is the rate, right?
The other thing that I could see happening, and again, I this is the perspective from some mortgage folks and real estate folks at a symposium that I was at this week. I could see that, and this is where you see small, incremental, day-to-day, pent up something. Remember the pent up demand is from the pandemic is the best, most clear example of pent up travel, right? We didn't travel for a year or a year and a half or 2 years. And then travel just exploded because we, and Americans kind of had to put that on hold for a while. And then it just, to some extent, you could say it wreaked havoc or it had a sizable impact on the travel industry. So what's happening today? You've got now the lowest level of home transactions that we've seen in 15, 20 years, because people are relatively locked into their low rates, yet families every single day are growing. So you've got now two kids, and now your house may be starting to feel a little small. And then you have a third kid or a fourth child. And all of the people that are feeling like they're busting at the seams are still waiting because A, they can't find a house, and B, rates are really high. So we have what I would consider the economic sink in this particular group, which would be one eventual home buyers to larger homes, the sink is getting full. It's filling and filling and filling. So it will be interesting to see, Connor, in a year or two or three from now, let's say rates go back to 5. So we're at around 7% today on 30-year mortgage. Let's say we go back to 5. does that mean the housing market all of a sudden starts to loosen up? But wait a minute, we've got a giant sink full of people, massive demand, a tidal wave of demand of people that have wanted to buy for a couple of years now. And then maybe housing doesn't, maybe housing has another surge in price because of that. Is that, do you see that in your growing family or in your peer groups?
Well, yeah, I mean, really it's a question of human behavior, right? It's how quickly do we become adapted to this arena of higher mortgage rates, right? Are we going to be accustomed to 7% mortgages so that 5% looks attractive? Or are we thinking, well, in the back of my mind, a couple of years ago, we could get 3, so 5 is still above that. I think we're pretty adaptable, and we'll probably think that 5% is a bargain from where we're at today.
As soon as rates drop, right? Yeah. It's human behavior. Speaking of higher home prices that we're still living with here, we're on Inflation Watch every day. I think it was Wednesday, CPI came out. Thursday, PPI came out, which was also a relatively cool number. Let's talk about the inflation number. So we got inflation, CPI, consumer price index that we watch every single month. These are the August numbers that came out this month of September, moved up to 3.7%. So consumer prices rose, though, at least the headline was at the fastest pace in more than a year. And a lot of that had to do with energy costs. We've seen it. We've seen oil prices go up. We've seen gasoline prices go up. As you and I were looking at inflation numbers this past week, when we got to the 3% handle a couple of months ago, a big part of that was what?
The biggest piece of that was energy. I think
coming down energy from the coming, year prior.
Yeah, because you look at where oil prices were a year ago in June, they were over $100 a barrel, whereas this past June, it was more like $70 a barrel. So you had this big contraction in prices, which also weighed down inflation.
There was an analogy I heard about this. So here we are, we've gone from 9 down to 3, back to 3.7% on headline inflation. And there's a Bank of America economist this week, I think had a good analogy around this. And he said that slowing inflation in, let's call it last, at the beginning of this year and earlier this summer, essentially signaled that what the Fed was doing was working, right? They had raised rates and inflation was coming in really quickly. But that progress, like a football team who marches it all the way down the field, and then they get to the 5-yard line. And I think in a lot of instances, that final 5 yards is the toughest 5 yards to get. And I think that's what the Federal Reserve is facing today. We'll talk more about inflation and go over an inflation example around the iPhone. And we had Apple just announced new iPhones this past week. We'll discuss right here on Money Matters straight ahead. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here Sunday morning. And Connor Miller joins us in the studio. The headline of the week, of course, CPI data. The market reacted relatively benign the day of CPI, relatively flat. So even though the number was a little higher than we wanted it to be, the market's not fretting so much about higher rates means lower stock market prices, at least at this point. But Connor, we were talking about the energy component of that and a lot of the progress we made with bringing the headline inflation down, which includes energy, over 9 down to the low 3s. A big part of that was energy. And then is that we've started to see oil prices start going back up. That's a big part of these numbers.
Yeah. And that's really the biggest dynamic that we've seen in the last few months, from inflation going down from 9% over a year ago to 3%. Bottoming, now up a little bit. And really the biggest piece of that was the decline in oil prices that we saw. And so really from June to June, we hit on this, oil prices declined about 40%. And so what that did is it brought down overall inflation in the same period. Now that oil prices are ticking a little bit higher, we're starting to see that become less and less of the overall inflation print.
You know, the IEA this week, or it was the EIA, or one of the global energy forecasters came out this week with a forecast that we would see peak energy demand sometime in, what was it, 2030?
2030, so
it's,
yeah.
It's only, it's what, 6.5 years from now?
Yeah.
And I've heard a lot of pushback on that, which seems to me almost ridiculous that we're going to peak with fossil fuels. And we spent some time this week looking at some of these estimates. If you're looking at the penetration of electric vehicles, first of all, I think it's fascinating to think that about, what, 40 to 45% of petroleum is used for vehicles. So cars, and then there's another big chunk for cargo, right?
Yep, that's right.
But even bigger than that is fossil fuel used in industrial products, right? So the reality here is that and I had to, it's hard to conceive for me how on any given day, more oil is used to make stuff, whether it's rubber shoes or what are some of the categories?
It's any plastic, it's any rubber, it's any type of wax or lubricant. All of those products are petroleum based. And so you start looking around, you see pretty much everything you interact with on a day-to-day basis is derived from some form of petroleum.
Right. Plastics, synthetic fabrics, cosmetics, cleaning products, electronics, footwear, paintings, coated adhesive, ink. The list goes on and on. But imagine how many people are filling up their tanks in any given day and the oil that is used to do that. Even more oil every single day is used in all the things that are manufactured on the planet. So to think that we're going to have peak oil demand just because of EVs, we'll go over these numbers. We've got to run to quick news, weather, traffic. Just doesn't seem even remotely realistic. We'll talk about that when Money Matters returns. Stay tuned. Is your cash working for you? For years, banks have gotten away with paying next to nothing for the privilege of holding your money. Today, investors have more options as the Federal Reserve has raised and raised and raised interest rates dramatically. Why not take advantage of it? If you're interested in finding a higher yielding solution for the safety allocation of your investment portfolio, reach out to my team at yourwealth.com. It's yourwealth.com.
It's WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss. Certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future.
Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here on a Sunday morning. During the break, Connor Miller brought up this chart that we had looked at earlier this week that had to do with where all the fossil fuel goes. We're talking about this because it is a huge part of inflation. And I know there's this massive shift to electric vehicles. And the thought is that if we have more electric vehicles, we're going to reduce fossil fuels dramatically. One of the big global energy organizations came out this week and said, we're going to peak oil demand in 2030. That's like day after tomorrow. And they're assuming this massive uptake of electric vehicles replacing ICE cars. By the way, what ICE is what? The internal combustion engine is ICE?
Internal combustion engine.
They call them ICE cars.
Yep.
Because it's internal combustion engine.
We used to just call them cars before EVs came around.
That's true. There was no such thing. They're all internal combustion. And then so the estimates to eliminate the thought of having internal combustion engines is shocking to me at how quickly we think we can get rid of what we would consider the original cars that still drive around today. By the way, today are still 99% or so, 98% of the cars on the road are still internal combustion. Yet a lot of these forecasts say they're going to be essentially off the road in 6 years, 8 years, 10 years. But even, and this is what's amazing to me, even if that were to happen, that's what a lot of these forecasts are assuming. the other almost half of what petroleum is used for are all these other industrial products. And that to me is what is so fascinating, that for everything that we, every gallon of gasoline we put in a vehicle, and what are the percentages again, Connor?
So yeah, looking at this chart, you have passenger vehicles, 27%, commercial vehicles, so trucks, things like that, 17%. Another 13% goes to other transportation, airlines, shipping. The rest of that, the rest of the 43% is all non-transportation. So it's plastics, it's heating your homes, it's industrial manufacturing, things like that.
Cleaning products, cosmetics, petroleum-based ingredients, lotions, creams, lipsticks. It's just synthetic fabric. It's hard for me to wrap my head around the amount of petroleum that's used to get to move things around the world, which we see every day. We see gas stations are full. You have to wait in line. To think that that almost that same amount of petroleum in any given day is just going into the things that we buy at CVS for the most part.
Yeah.
And that, curbing that to me seems just as hard or harder than the thought that we're going to replace internal combustion engines over the next handful of years.
Well, and again, that's only a quarter of the pie, because there's been a lot of popularity of EVs in the consumer space, in the passenger vehicle space, but we still haven't made huge strides in commercial vehicles. So we're still just talking about a really small piece of the overall consumption pie.
What would we make sneakers out of? Without a rubber sole, could you do recycled?
I'm sure someone out there is trying to do it.
What am I missing? I don't know.
I don't know.
Well, anyway, we're not here to figure that out. What we're here to figure out is the impact of inflation. And we've talked about how we've continued to see inflation. It's that extra, it's the final 5 yards. We're deep into the red zone of curing inflation, getting to the Fed's 2% target. But it's that last 5 yards that often is the toughest. So it may be a while before we're able to get to the Fed's 2% goal. But at the same time, I think about what Apple announced this week, and they have a whole new lineup. It's the iPhone 15. It's the new Apple Watch. It's the new MacBooks. So it's an entire new suite of products with new bells and new whistles. But talk about a lack of inflation, or you would almost call it deflation, or really it is deflation if you go through and really look at these numbers. So let's go back. The new iPhone 15 that just got announced is going to start at $799. The iPhone 15 Pro, $990. Let's call it $1,000. The least expensive iPhones are made with aluminum. The Pro models have been made out of surgical steel, which evidently makes them stronger but heavier. This year's Pro, here's an upgrade. They're going to be a titanium frame, which weighs less. Apple said that this titanium is the same titanium used on the most recent Mars rover. So it's more durable. Okay, that's exciting. But the biggest change in this new lineup of iPhones is that they're switching over to the USB-C port after 11 years of using the Lightning cable. And I think a lot of that has to do with the European Union legislated that all of their smartphones, tablets, digital cameras, portable speakers, all use the same USB-C. So now Apple essentially has to do the same thing. But let's look at some technological deflation. If we go back and we look at the original iPhone back in 2007, was $499. So maybe on the surface you'd say, well, now we're paying $300 more than we did for that same iPhone back in 2007. However, that would be ignoring inflation or the impact of inflation. If you look at what $499 back in 07 would look like today, adjusted for inflation, it would actually be $735 today. And the brand new iPhone is $799. So think about this. After 16 years, and it feels like it was not that long ago, but 16 years of innovation, every single new iteration, better cameras, more storage, faster compute, is only $64 more in today's dollars than it was first introduced in 2007. At the same time, the newer iPhones are five times better than the original, maybe 10. I don't know if it's 5 times. Is it 8 times?
I mean, you've got a way better camera. Now you've got all the apps. Remember the original iPhone, you couldn't even download apps on it. That didn't come till later. And so now all the different things that your
iPhone. So they were just preloaded in the beginning. It was just whatever apps came on that original iPhone. I don't know if I even remember that.
I think it was like a year later that they actually came out with the App Store. You had, you know, your calculator on there, your photo album, iTunes, things like that. But couldn't even download apps.
And I remember when you were using the web browser, it wasn't really all that good.
A lot slower. Yeah, now they're shooting movies on the new iPhones with how good the cameras are. So really, when you think about the capability of a new one is so much better than what it was 16 years ago.
Well, think about also what's happened to the markets and to the economy over that period of time. If you go back to 07 and you look at what's happened, we've seen a rise in the S&P 500 of almost 200%. Since that iPhone 1 came out in June of 2007, despite the Great Recession, which was 2007, 2008, and part of 2009, that was the most significant downturn since the Great Depression. Housing crisis, that turned upside down. Financial firms were taking on too much risk. Bear Stearns essentially collapsed. Then we had a global recession. The S&P 500 at one point was down 57% during the Great Financial Crisis. Then we had a global recession through COVID, lockdowns, masks, no masks, back to masks, back to no masks, media hysteria. S&P 500 was down 34% during that period of time. So since the release of the first iPhone, despite a 57% drop in the market, a great financial crisis, a pandemic, a shutdown, another 34% drop in the S&P 500, yet here we are today, still up about 200%, around 197%. But I'm rounding. For investors that have stayed patient and essentially been able to drive through and see on the other side of the smoke, the clouds, and all the scary headlines that we've lived through. And that lesson is a really good reminder for why we continue to invest to this day and why we have to continue to be optimistic about the future, or else money's just sitting in a bank account. And that, it's very difficult to get to where we need to be if we're just saving and we're not also investing at the same time. I had a question this week at this forum I was speaking at, Connor, that asked about the cause of inflation and whose fault it was. And it became a little bit of a political question. Is it Democrats' fault or is it Republicans' fault? And what we can do about it, is it ever gonna be cured? And after thinking about it for a minute, you could either party can blame either party for the inflation. Right? It was the Republicans when COVID started, lots of stimulus to try to get through COVID, and then it was Democrats that continued it. Either party you could point a finger at. The reality here is that the whole reason we invest to begin with, primary reason number one, is to be able to protect purchasing power. We know that if we're just in T-bills over the course of history, or we're just in cash, or we're just in money markets, then we rarely ever outpace inflation. But we forgot about inflation as investors because we had such a low level of it for so long. We didn't just have a year where inflation was really benign. We had over a decade where inflation was almost non-existent. If you look back at these numbers, 2008, we had a tenth of a percent of inflation. In 2010, we had 1.5% inflation. 2012, it was 1.7. 13, it was 1.5. In 2014, and this was a decent economy. We had less than 1% inflation for the whole year of 2014. And then in 2015, less than 1% inflation. So we were lulled to sleep about the importance of investing to be able to protect our purchasing power because we were trying to outpace inflation. And I think today, with this latest number at 3.7% or so, that we have to be extra mindful about the whole reason we're investing is to try to outpace inflation to begin with. Because you think, Connor, and I agree with you on this point, that we're going to have slightly higher inflation for a while. So these trends continue. And your number one reason for higher inflation is what?
Is really higher wages. I mean, you look at it, wages are still growing 4.5% year over year. And so when you think about if companies have to pay their workers more, they're going to pass on those higher costs to the consumer, and the consumer is going to have to pay more. And that's what inflation is.
Well, and then the consumer has more with wage inflation in their pocket, so they're willing to spend a little bit more.
Yeah.
So it's this upward spiral of companies raising prices, workers saying, I need more money. We continue to see UAW, the Teamsters, unions coming back and having more and more power, raising wages. And they're getting paid 10%, 20%, 30% more, and then that's going back into the economy. So it stands to reason that we're going to be living in a 2.5%, 3.5%, maybe 4% average inflation environment really for a while, mm-hmm. which just makes investing to try to outpace that much more important. Of course, one of my favorite charts before we go to break, and then we'll talk more about how we outpace inflation, why this is a good time for income investors, is that we've seen over the course of the last 150 years that the dividend on the S&P 500 has grown at almost double the pace of what our average inflation has been. Just the cash flow from the market in general has grown at almost double the pace of inflation in almost any time period you look at. So if we're looking for an answer to outpace inflation, look no further than equities and particularly cash payouts. We'll talk about income investing right after weather traffic. More money matters right here on WSB Radio, straight ahead. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here. It is Sunday morning. Your host, Wes Moss. Today in the studio, happy to be joined by Connor Miller, co-chief investment strategist at Capital. Thanks for being here, Connor. And we were just talking about inflation before the break.
Yeah, you went back over the last 150 years, all the way back to 1871.
It's a long time.
Really long time, especially for financial data. But how dividends have outpaced the rate of inflation by nearly 2 to 1, 3.7% growth for dividends.
Growth. This is dividend growth, annualized growth of the dividend.
That's right. So every year you're getting a 3.7% increase in those dividends versus 2% for inflation.
So almost double.
And so what we've been looking at is, okay, well, that's great. That's held true, but we're in a different regime of inflation. And so we went back and looked over the last 12 months. We wanted to see if this still held true, and it does. So over the last 12 months, dividends have been raised by 8%. This is looking at the S&P 500, whereas inflation has been about 3.7%. And we've been tracking this probably for about a year now. So even when inflation was 9%, the pace of dividends still outpaced inflation.
Explain how it's only 3.7%. I thought inflation was 9.
So the way that most people talk about inflation is over the last 12 months, so a year-over-year basis. So basically, prices have increased by 3.7% over the last 12 months. Dividends have grown by more than double that, 7.9% over the last 12 months.
So it still holds true even over that really short period of time. And really, I think another thing that I wanted to revisit or recap, we talked about this at length last week here on Money Matters, but as a recap, putting the last couple of years into perspective, stocks essentially have been flat over the last 2 years, whether you look at the Dow or the S&P 500. The bond index is lower significantly over the last couple of years, but that's because rates have gone up. And if we were looking over the horizon, as we should as investors, all that's taken place in both the equity and the fixed income or the bond market has raised interest rates. And yes, it's been rough for those who are looking to go buy a new house and having to pay higher mortgage rates, but it's really a positive development for income investors. And if you look at now a balanced portfolio that at one point, and when I say balance, I mean 60% in equities and 40% in fixed income or bonds. Back in 2020 and 2021, the yield was only around 1.4 to 1.5%. Today, Connor, that balanced portfolio is what?
Is all the way up to about 3%.
Largely because interest rates on fixed income have gone up materially, which is typically a good sign for the next several years to come for fixed income investors. We put that together in a balanced portfolio. And even though it's been a grind or a frustrating 2 years for equity investors and really rough for those invested in bonds, a starting point of 3% yield for a balanced way to invest, that's more than double it's been over the last couple of years. So we'll wrap up on that piece of positive news for income investors and anyone that's eyeing retirement or in retirement. All of these changes, I think, are a real tailwind for the next cycle for investors. Connor Miller, thanks for being here on Money Matters. You can find me, the whole Money Matters team, easy to do so at yourwealth.com. That's yourwealth.com. Have a wonderful rest of your Sunday.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.